some form or other of harassment, which was verbal, physical, sexual, almost every time we worked together.
A former Haines police dispatcher speaks out about the state's new ferry security officer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, families accept the remains of loved ones who died in a crash on an Alaska glacier 60 years ago.
You never give up totally. You always think that he would be found or he would come home somehow.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Governor Sean Parnell wants his staff to examine the hiring process for state employees after APRN reported a former police officer hired with the ferry system has a checkered past. Several people who talked about Jason Joel's job performance for a previous story did not want to share their identity, including a former Haines police dispatcher who alleges Joel harassed her on the job. Now she is speaking out. Margaret Friedenauer of member station KHNS has the story.
46-year-old Angie Goodwin started at the Haines Police Department as a dispatcher in 2009. By then, Jason Joel had been on the job for 3 years. Goodwin says at first she considered him a friendly coworker, but slowly, she said Joel's comments and actions toward her turned from friendly and joking to crude and harassing.
It was so gradual that by the time it got bad, you know, I didn't realize that I was in like, uh-oh, now what am I going to do kind of thing, you know? I mean, because at first, you know, there was a lot of, you know, he joked around and stuff, but it wasn't, you know, it was just joking. You know, he just gradually pushes his way in and you let him come in because you feel safe. He's a police officer.
Goodwin says the alleged verbal harassment was sometimes sexual. Occasionally, it included physical contact. Once Joel picked Goodwin up over his shoulder, she says. Another time he grabbed her wrist. And she says the harassment became constant.
There was some form or other of harassment, which was verbal, physical, sexual, almost every time we worked together.
Goodwin says there were witnesses to the harassment, but none who could be reached for comment. Several other women in Haines and Skagway say they either witnessed or experienced harassment by Joel, but have not wanted their names used publicly. As the harassment increased, Goodwin says she became more stressed. She began seeing a counselor. She mentioned some of the incidents to her doctor when she complained of not being able to sleep. In 2011, she decided to finally make an official complaint to Chief of Police Gary Lowe.
I was on edge as it was, and I just got really upset. And I called him, and he had just left there. He was almost home when he answered his phone. I lost it. I started crying. I said, I need you to come in here. I said, I have something very important you need to know.
About 2 weeks later, she says the chief told her Joel had resigned. The borough confirms that Joel was allowed to resign in a deal signed by Joel, the borough manager, and a public employees union representative. Goodwin resigned a few weeks after Joel. She says she wanted out of the department.
I was sick of it. I was so burnt out at that point, couldn't stand it. I just wanted out at that point.
Shortly before she resigned, Goodwin began documenting incidents of harassment from Joel. She also has a letter she wrote to an attorney asking for guidance. But after Joel surrendered his state police certification, she quit pursuing legal action. When Goodwin heard Joel had been hired as a security officer with the state, she was upset and decided to finally speak out.
He's dealing with 5,000 times more people now than he was dealing with at the police department. I mean, this isn't just small town Haines now that he's dealing with. Now he's got the whole state underneath him. Like, what were they thinking? But there's no way for them to be able to dig it up because the borough, every place he resigned from, has hidden it in one way or another.
Joel has not responded to email requests for comment. The Haynesboro, along with other police departments he's worked for, say his personnel file is confidential and won't confirm any complaints were ever leveled against him. But the allegations and documented work history were enough to get some lawmakers, and now the governor's, attention. Department of Transportation spokesperson Jeremy Woodrow.
The governor's asked Commissioner Kemp to look into the hiring process, and we are following through with that request.
Exactly how DOT Commissioner Pat Kemp will examine the process is not yet clear, Woodrow says.
And it's important to point out that Mr. Joel is a state employee, and so anything that the state does regarding his employment has to be done under the strict guidelines that follow state procedure.
Some state hiring policies are developed by the Department of Administration and could be changed by staff. Others are outlined in state statute and would require the legislature to take action. But right now, Woodrow says details of the hiring process are confidential. State Representative for Haynes, Democrat Jonathan Christ Tompkins, says he hopes Kemp will share the results of his examination of the hiring process with the public.
I think Governor Parnell directing Commissioner Kemp to look into this is a needed and positive step, and I hope they come full circle and, you know, let us know what happened.
Senator Dennis Egan, also a Democrat and chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, has sent a letter to Commissioner Kemp asking him to look into the hiring of Joel, according to Egan's staff. Reporting from Haynes, I'm Margaret Friednauer.
In Congress today, a bill that would allow foreign students to work in Alaska fish processing plants cleared a major committee. The provision is part of a spending bill now headed to the Senate floor. Both Alaska senators say they pressed for the return of the J-1 visa program to help meet demand for seasonal seafood processors. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the program is controversial.
J-1 visas are intended to promote cultural exchange. As the State Department explains it, the work is secondary.
This program offers exchange participants a hands-on experience to learn about U.S. society and culture.
But some U.S. employers and overseas recruiters exploited the program, exposing students only to the culture of hard labor, night shifts, and squalid housing. After a protest at a Hershey factory in Pennsylvania, the State Department changed the rules in 2012. It barred J-1 students from certain jobs, including seafood processing. The Alaska industry had been hiring several thousand J-1s a year. Daniel Costa, who researches immigration issues for the Economic Policy Institute, says the processors should not be allowed to employ J-1s again.
It was being used more as a cheap labor program.
Costa says Alaska fish plants aren't a good place for these students to fulfill the purpose of the visa.
They're stuck out in the middle of nowhere in isolated towns where there aren't a lot of cultural exchange activities to do.
The U.S. has another type of visa for temporary workers, the H-2B. Costa says fish processors should really hire H-2Bs, but then they'd have to run ads announcing the vacancies to locals first. So employers prefer J-1.
They don't have to do the advertising. They don't have to pay any of the taxes, Medicare, Social Security, that sort of thing.
Recruitment agencies even have J-1 savings calculators on their websites, showing employers they can save nearly 8% per worker if they hire J-1s. Dennis Phelan of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association says his members search near and far for seasonal workers, including from Alaska's job centers.
They will tell you we hire every qualified person that they send us, but that is just a fraction of what we need.
They hire some H-2B visa holders, but he says that program is too complicated and the number of visas issued is limited. Phelan says, though, the processing gig is good for J-1 students.
The way the salmon season tends to work, there tends to be a good bit of overtime, and so then they get paid time and a half for that. But plus, they obviously have three room and board, so they have virtually no expenses and are making more than minimum wage.
In the past, he says, the students had their cultural experience after working.
The students then, once they had finished their contract and had made the money, the vast majority of them then head out, travel across Alaska, travel across other parts of the United States.
The State Department says that's not good enough anymore. Phelan says if they're allowed to hire J-1s again, the processors know they'll have to provide cultural enrichment during the work period.
Obviously, these are not heavily populated areas where the plants are, and so your opportunities for things like that are somewhat limited, but obviously we'll do everything we can to make sure that the students are getting out.
If the visa provision survives negotiations with the House in the months ahead, it would allow foreign students to work as fish processors only through September 2015. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, learning Aleutic at a language immersion retreat in Kodiak.
It's a big reward for future generations because, like, say, when I grew up, there was nothing like this at all.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
The remains of 17 service members who died in a 1952 plane crash near Mount Gannett have been identified by the Department of Defense. An Alaska National Guard Black Hawk helicopter crew discovered the crash site 2 summers ago on Colony Glacier during a training exercise. A team went back to the site to recover what they could later that month. The identified remains will be returned to families all over the country and given burials with full military honors. KSKA's Ann Hillman spoke with some of the families.
Mary May and her younger brother, Bill Turner, were the middle siblings in a pack of 6 kids growing up in rural Pennsylvania in the 1930s.
We lived on a tiny little valley. We knew nothing about the outside world. And so your family was all you had.
May says her brother loved airplanes and joined the Air Force when he finished school. He was 22 and headed to Korea when the C-124 Globemaster he was navigating crashed with 52 people on board.
It was a kid trying to realize his dream, you know, and it was cut short, I guess.
Bad weather made it impossible for search parties to recover the remains of the plane in the winter of 1952. May says she never had closure from his death.
You never give up totally. You always think that he would be found or he would come home somehow.
When some of the wreckage was spotted in 2012, May says she began to hope. Like other relatives of the victims, she gave a sample of her DNA to the Department of Defense forensic labs. The scientists there managed to match it with the bones of her brother's leg. May says she was shocked when she learned they found her brother. She says she shouted the news to her daughter, but then she didn't know what to say.
You didn't want to accept it before, and now you still don't want to accept it. I don't know. It's just a hard thing to live through.
May says she thinks burying the remains alongside her mother will help. For Michael Williams, the death of his brother-in-law, Howard Martin, in the 60-year-old crash was something his wife's family would never discuss.
When it was bought up, it immediately brought tears, so I basically did all my research in secret, so not to upset anybody. I just wanted to find out a little more detail than what the family revealed.
William says his research connected him with other families around the country who were also seeking closure on the issue. They formed relationships through email and Facebook and remembered even when others forgot.
It's kind of disappeared in the fog of time, and fortunately, the Alaska National Guard noticed something and decided to take a look down on Colony Glacier. They could have easily just flown over it and said, that's nothing, went down there and investigated, but they got curious, and the families do appreciate it.
But for other families, they will continue to wait. The remains of 35 of the 52 victims are still lost on the mountain, though the Department of Defense says they will keep looking. In memory of those who died, The mountain where they perished was recently renamed Globe Master Peak. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
It's been 1 year since the Stewart Creek II wildfire was reported burning in the Yukon training area northeast of Fairbanks. The blaze, ignited during an Army artillery training exercise, burned more than 87,000 acres. Later, military officials conducted multiple investigations to find out why Army leaders signed off on the use of high explosive ammunition at a time when the National Weather Service had issued red flag warnings. In response, training procedures have been rewritten. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Deputy Commanding Officer Colonel Adam Lang signs off on training that takes place at Fort Wainwright.
You know, we're certainly putting a lot more rigor into it. You know, based on the experiences last year, we certainly don't want anything like that to repeat again.
But Lang hasn't always been the guy in charge when it comes to training exercises that take place during the wildfire season. Last June, a field artillery unit trained with live fire when the fire weather index indicated high or extreme conditions. Fort Wainwright's fire chief didn't approve live fire that week, but was repeatedly overridden by an installation range officer based more than 300 miles away at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The overrides prompted the Director of Emergency Services to email then-Deputy Commanding Officer Colonel Ron Johnson. He's since retired. In response, Johnson emailed Colonel Mark Narum at JBEAR, who oversees training and operations for U.S. Army Alaska. "Our fire situation is critical," wrote Johnson. "Please make sure your people have a very clear picture of the situation here before they decide to override the fire recommendations from the fire professionals," the email continues. "I can tell you that it isn't based on a bunch of civilians trying to keep soldiers from conducting training," wrote Johnson. The email was sent only a day before Stewart Creek II was reported. It was ignited by artillery used during the training. 2 weeks later, the blaze had grown beyond 80,000 acres. Residents in Two Rivers, as well as their sled dogs and livestock, were evacuated as the fire approached the community 20 miles from Fairbanks.
My sense is that the community is a little raw about last year. You know, there was a lot of emotion surrounding the Stewart Creek fire.
Colonel Lang has replaced Colonel Johnson. He says the Army has since adopted a new approach to live fire training at times when wildfire danger is high.
It's okay under these conditions now because many of our train-ups now are not tied to a unit getting ready to go out the door to deploy to go to war right away, to say, well, do we really have to do that? Can we do it another way? And if there's an answer yes to any of those questions, well, then maybe we do it another way or we do it another day.
This year, Colonel Lang has the authority to approve waiver requests for training when there are red flag warnings. Earlier this spring, he says he signed off on just such a waiver.
So we have some ranges where you can shoot into what is an old ribbon of a river that's nothing but rock and gravel with no fuels in it whatsoever, and there's still standing water and ice in there left over from winter. That'd be a great place to shoot high explosive artillery right now.
But some of the changes to procedures won't come easy. A report that came from one investigation suggests the acquisition of artillery rounds that don't set fire to the forest floor. Colonel Lang says that's easier said than done.
It turns out the Army has some, but it's very little stockage of it. And so U.S. Army Alaska has requested to receive a bunch, and we have not been able to get the Army to grant us permission to use that. The Army has very large stocks of traditional 155 high-explosive ammunition, and they want us to use that ammunition before it becomes no good any longer.
Lang says the recommended ammunition might be available for training at Fort Wainwright in fiscal year 2016. A final report on what happened with Stewart Creek II also calls for more coordination and training with the Bureau of Land Management's Alaska Fire Service. Those meetings do take place. The report also recommends AFS acquire thermal sight equipment to pinpoint hotspots during monitoring missions. According to a spokesman at AFS, fire managers already use infrared technology when they fly over fires. A final suggestion calls for a review of the Memorandum of Agreement between the Army and the Alaska Fire Service. That effort is ongoing. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
If you're having trouble taking medications or forgetting to take pills on time, there's help available for these serious common problems. Talk to your prescriber or pharmacist right away and visit meded.alaska.gov. There you'll find tips on safety, saving money, and more. When you take your medications as directed, you protect your health and independence. You protect your future. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A handful of leading advocates for the new oil tax regime made the case for keeping the law last night. The forum was hosted by the Anchorage Young Republicans, and panelists included economist Scott Goldsmith and State Senator Kathy Geisel. They argued that if voters repealed the new tax law in August, the oil companies could abandon development of a natural gas pipeline. The event wasn't a debate, and the invited panelists all spoke against returning to a system where the tax rate increases along with the price of oil. Anchorage Chamber of Commerce President Andrew Halcrow moderated the event, and many of the questions he took from the floor expressed support for the tax law.
With this much data seemingly in favor of SB 21, how can anyone disagree anymore? Not a loaded question.
Proponents of the referendum were not invited to speak, but they were allowed to rent a table outside the forum. Ray Metcalf, who served in the legislature in the 80s, was on his own manning the booth, offering bumper stickers to a crowd that seemed less than eager to take them.
How are you going to convert anybody if you don't go into the lion's den?
Metcalf thinks he persuaded two of the attendees to vote for the referendum by showing them that other oil-producing nations tax at a higher rate than Alaska. The referendum will appear on the August 19th primary ballot. Days after lifting restrictions on one river in the Susitna drainage, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is shutting down king salmon fishing entirely on another. A Fish and Game emergency order will close fishing for kings at 12:01 a.m. on Friday on the Little Susitna River south of the park's highway bridge. According to Fish and Game, only 19 king salmon have passed the counting weir, and about 200 kings have been harvested. Fish and Game says low water levels are causing the fish to stay further downriver, which makes them more vulnerable to being caught. The low end of the escapement goal for the Little Sioux is 900 kings. A very different story has unfolded on the Deschka River. There, the minimum escapement of 13,000 has already been achieved, and Fish and Game lifted some fishing restrictions. The Deschka was already the only river in the Susitna drainage that allowed seven-day-a-week harvest. Now anglers will be allowed to use bait and fishing gear with multiple hooks. The Aleutic Museum held a language immersion retreat this week in Kodiak. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs has more.
Aleutic Museum Director Alicia Drayback said the whole purpose of the immersion was to help people learn the Aleutic language in fun, interactive ways.
Be together and speaking the language. So the activities are chosen because they're culturally appropriate or they allow us to exchange language in a really effective way for teaching. So it teaches good verbs and conversational fluency.
This is the second year the museum has hosted the language immersion, which is sponsored by the Kodiak Island Borough School District. Despite the change of location, Drabeck said this year's event was a success.
We've played games in Aleutic, we've made crafts. They're right now getting ready to play balichkak, which is a type of hide-and-seek that's traditional for the Aleutic people.
You have one person who's it, then everybody else has to hide.
That's Sheila Kulan-Limeberger, who traveled from the village of Uzinki to participate in the two-day language immersion.
And then when they stop counting, the person who's it needs to come and pound on the drum when they see a kid coming towards the base. And so the plan is for all the kids who are hiding to come and pound on the drum before the person who's it.
Achwilchen, Matungen, Engulchen, Kongoyen, Kulen.
Balichkak, balichkak, balichkak. And then everybody who comes in can help the others to come in. So it's everybody against it.
Kulan Leinberger said she's glad she made the trip into town and said it was fun to watch all the different levels of language learning.
It's been good because everybody is helping each other. I don't know that many words, really. I still need to hear a lot of the language, so everybody helps everybody else.
Immersion activities continued inside the college, where John Yakinak worked on a beaded headband for his daughter.
I cut out a strip of dyed purple leather
for a backing. Then I took a strip of rabbit fur and glued that down together. And I think the next step for me is to stitch it in. But it looks really nice. And then I beaded tassels down through the end ones being longer, and then they get shorter as it goes to the center of the headband.
Yakanak was born in Kodiak, but now lives in Anchorage. He said he became involved in the Aleutic language while taking online distance learning classes offered through Kodiak College.
Growing up, something I always wanted to do was be able to speak my native language, and I always wondered how come I was never taught growing up. And it was just, the answer was, well, because we were never taught. So obviously it didn't get passed down, so it was always something I wanted to do.
He said the rise in opportunities for Aleutic language learning are incredible, and events like the two-day retreat weren't available even a decade ago.
It's a big reward for future generations because, like, say, when I grew up, there was nothing like this at all.
Elder Florence Pesterkoff has helped with the language revitalization over the past two decades and said it's rewarding to see young children learning words and phrases from a language that was almost lost.
I like teaching the Aleutic language because I think people that learn it here are becoming whole people. You're not fragmented so much. It's wonderful. It's really great. And I sense I hate to use the word pride, but it does bring out who they really are.
Dre Beck said the number of Aleutic language speakers has grown tremendously over the past two decades. She estimates there are about 11 intermediate to advanced second language speakers, and classes offered through the high school and college are adding to that each year. Online distance delivery has opened the Aleutic language to the worldwide community, so she said it's difficult to estimate how many people are learning the language at any given time.
But I do know that of the first language speakers, there are about 26 living on the island that are fluent speakers that grew up learning, speaking the language. So it's not very many when you look at it that way, but the growing number of people that are learning, we're starting to make ground, and now we're able to converse with our first language speakers. So it's really exciting.
Dre Beck said the momentum is only growing, and the two-day language immersion is a true testament to that. Children as young as two played games and shouted words in Aleutic. Many of them aren't fluent yet, but they're trying. And according to Dre Beck, that in itself is a mark of success.
Shunamak hui Brianna Gibbs.
From Kodiak, I'm Brianna Gibbs.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.